I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest is Michael Kellett. He's executive director of the New England nonprofit organization Restore the North Woods, which he co-founded in 1990. He's been involved in national park, wilderness, public land. In 1994, he developed the proposal for a 3.2 million acre Maine Woods National Park, which laid the groundwork for the 2016 designation by President Obama of Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. In Massachusetts, he has worked to protect Walden Woods and Henry David Thoreau's birthplace and helped to develop legislation introduced in 2019, which would protect state conservation lands from logging and other development. So first off, thank you for all your great work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So today, I would like to talk about an article you recently co-wrote called Forest Clearing to Create Early Successional Habitats: Questionable Benefits, Significant Costs. So can you sort of start from the beginning and tell us about the article and the underlying ecological issue?
Yes, as you alluded to in the introduction, my efforts for the last 30 plus years, 35 plus really, have been to protect wilderness and wildlands and national parks and state parks and the wildlife that need those areas. And so that's been my focus. I have been involved in the past logging and forestry issues and so forth over time, but that really hasn't been my focus. And because my feeling is we need permanent protection for areas, and that's, so anyway, that's what I focus on. Well, I found that a big hindrance to this effort has been not just the forest industry saying, oh, we have to cut down trees because people need toilet paper and houses and whatever, which is the standard argument we've heard forever, but that we had actually scientists and conservationists and others saying, oh, well, we have to cut down trees, we have to cut down standing forests because we need it for wildlife habitat. We don't have enough early successional habitat, which is young forest or scrubby open habitats. That's the same thing. And we don't have enough of that. And because of that, we've got a bunch of birds and other wildlife that are in real trouble. They've been declining and dangerously declining. And in fact, some of them are in danger of going extinct, perhaps, unless we intervene and manage these forests and greatly expand the amount of this early successional habitat. And so, sorry, that means you're just not going to be able to protect this area. We oppose you. And so, in fact, the bills that we have proposed in Massachusetts, we have conservation organizations, land trusts, and we have biologists and others opposing that, because not just the timber industry, but people you would think would be supporting biodiversity, they are opposing it because they say, this would prevent us from managing these forests to create this essential habitat. And so I started saying, wow, if this is really a problem, we got to figure out a way around this. You know, we can't just, of course, we don't want species to go extinct. I've heard this argument for a number of years. And so I started looking around and doing research and talking to people or whatever. And pretty soon I started to think, you know, this really sounds bogus to me, this whole argument. What's going on here? So I started researching, and then Joan Malouf had the same problem. She was coming to the same conclusions, and we started talking about getting more formal, doing some kind of paper or booklet or something. And then we talked to other scientists who also said, geez, you know, we've heard these same arguments too. So we pooled our resources and put this paper together. And it was shocking to me because it's way worse than I originally thought in terms of the extent of this. And it really is a campaign. We refer to it as a campaign. It really is a campaign by several different interests where this is kind of, this is a marriage of convenience that serves their interests. And it's become a huge problem across the, across the entire eastern United States. And they're even doing it in the West, I guess, to some extent, but especially in the East. And I should say, before I get any further, I think most of the people who are advocating for this are not evil, greedy, horrible people. I think they actually believe in this and think this is a good thing to do and are shocked that they are questioning it. But I just think they're dead wrong on this, and that they're, for various reasons, they're going in the wrong direction, in a very harmful direction ecologically. And I think a lot of it is the mentality of humans can and should manage everything. And it's the hubris of thinking, we know, we're experts, we got PhDs, and we've studied birds, we've done experimental clear cuts or whatever, and we know what we're doing, and we need to do this, and step aside, we got this under control. And if you tell us we can't manage, you're getting in the way, and that's a problem. So we just leave us alone. We will manage everything. Everything's going to be managed. And we don't, you know, sure, a few little wild land areas, little pockets of we'll leave alone, mainly stuff we don't want to do anything with. But otherwise, we need free rein to manage everything. And trust us, it's all going to work out great. That's the mentality that's gotten us here.
So thank you for that. And I have a whole bunch of directions to possibly go. I'm gonna list out some directions, and you can go whichever one you want, or whichever multiple ones you want. One of them would be take a couple of specific species and give their best argument. Another would be, back in the 90s, I interviewed Reed Noss, and one of the things he said to me that has always stuck with me, he was talking about the Forest Service using the excuse of increasing white-tailed deer habitat, using that as an excuse to clear cut. And he said, this is pretty close to a direct quote, it is insane to take a rarer ecotype like old growth forest and convert it into a more common type, as in clear cut or edges. That's the second possibility. A third possibility is, you know, all of this management ethos that so far in the West, they're not using we need it for bird habitat so much, but there have been, just in my activist life for the last 33 years, there have been multiple what Robert J. Lifton would call claims to virtue that have been put forward to log, as in the forests are sick, so we need to cut them down. There's a beetle infestation, so we need to cut them down. There is too heavy fire load, so we have to cut them down. And the thing that's common behind all of these is that we need to cut them down. And and everything else for me. And then one last possibility, which is when they're talking about cutting down these older forests, is this commercial logging? So are people going to make bank off this? Or is this, are they going to leave the trees lying there food for fireflies or habitat for fireflies? Okay, so those are, I'm done. So now you can talk about any or all of those for as long as you want.
Well, I'll talk about all of those because they're all totally relevant. I'll jump around, though. One of the thing about the menu of reasons for logging, that's all I've seen from the forestry and management people for the 35 years plus that I've been working on this. It's a menu of things, and they pick out whatever they think will work in a particular situation. But it's a reverse engineering from how can we cut this forest down or manage it? What reason can we give to do this other than we just want to do it? And And that's shifted over time. And so Reed and I was talking about they wanted to create more deer habitat. They don't say that anymore because they know that that's so ludicrous that with Lyme and everything that the people will laugh at them. So they don't say that anymore. But that's really a variation of what we're getting now, that we need to do it for golden winged warbler or woodcock or rough grouser. It's the same argument that basically we've, oh my God, these species don't have enough places to live and whatever. And I'll come back to that whole thing. But the other thing is that the commercial logging part, I actually think, sure, money greases the skids for all of this, and they couldn't do most of this logging without subsidies. It's almost all subsidized in some way. Most of this is not economically viable. They'll throw in some bigger trees, like at Sparta Mountain in New Jersey, which Joan probably talked about. They're clear cutting a mature forest in this supposed wildlife management area for early successional birds, supposedly. And they're cutting older oaks, which are economically valuable. But that really isn't what drove this. That's just like gravy that helps to pay for it. The reason is this whole thing about managing for early successional wildlife, and these guys would do it for free if they could. If they got, you know, they need a salary, of course. But it's ideology. It's really an ideology. And that I believe that's the case with all of this forestry stuff or whatever. Most of these people, fire, all of that, it really, you know, it's not like they're cynically trying to come up with excuses. They, you know, they're rationalizing why they want to do this. They want to be good people like anyone else. So I really think it's a kaleidoscope of excuses. But the problem is we can't let any of these slide by because they, you know, they'll use whatever works as long as it works. You know, fire in the West is a great one that they've been using like crazy, and it's working well for them. Biomass energy was working for a while until people did some math, some basic math, and figured out that it's totally crazy. It doesn't make any sense from an energy standpoint or a climate standpoint. But now they're coming back to it saying, oh my God, we have all this extra wood from saving the forest by cutting down the forest to save them from burning. So what are we going to do? Oh, gee, well, how about biomass? It's a win-win. So anyway, I should say that one of the things we found in our paper is that we couldn't find any species that needs cutting and logging intact standing forests to survive or thrive. There are none where there's really any credible evidence that they need this. You know, sure, there are species that use open habitats, and, you know, some of them go up or down in numbers, but that's been the case forever. I mean, that was the case before 1492. So the question is, do these species need humans to be artificially manipulating the habitats by cutting down existing forests, not just keeping openings that are already natural meadows or whatever? That's a different issue.
Here's how did golden winged warblers survive before the invention of chainsaws?
Well, that's one of the early successional habitat people. And we should talk about that. That's one of the main excuses for logging in New Jersey. And number one, golden-winged warblers were probably never super common. And there's plenty of evidence now that in New England, they probably weren't even in New England until all this, you know, during the 17 through the early 1900s. The northeastern U.S. was pretty much cleared of trees, and it was either turned into farms or pastures, you know, just scrubby areas that were cut over. And of course, golden winged warblers, they like sort of that kind of a habitat, a mix of of open and forest and whatever. And so they moved in, which is totally normal for any species. And and then when the forests in the Northeast started growing back in the 1900s, like many other spoilers, declined in numbers. And they also, and this is the case up and down the Appalachians, they were native further south along that. And, but now they've kind of moved to the north and the west. And the thinking, number one, no one really knows how many there are because there's really no easy way to count them. So there's not, it's not like they really have a solid idea of what's going on with the population. They just think that they're in terrible danger. Number one. Number two, there's another species, the blue-winged warbler, which is 9% genetically identical to the golden winged warbler. And there's been DNA testing of this and papers written. And the only difference is basically their coloring. And they also have a slightly different call, although they're so hard to tell apart, even by their call, they'll imitate each other. Some people think it's actually one species, just a variation of one species. And blue-winged warblers are all over the place. In fact, where they overlap, blue-winged warblers increase and golden-winged warblers decrease. The other thing is they spend time in the winter. They go down to South and Central America, where there's been a lot of clearing and logging and degradation of habitat. So what impact is that having? The other thing is, for years, and even now, the people who believe in this, you know, clearing for wildlife, golden-winged warblers need huge clear cuts, 25-acre clear cuts, to thrive and nest and so forth in the U.S. And that so that this is their excuse for these large-scale clearing. I mean, it's the kind of stuff that is shocking. Well, there's recent research that actually indicates that may not be true at all. And in fact, maybe that helps the blue-winged warbler more than the golden-winged warbler. And in fact, maybe golden-winged warbler is actually like a more diverse habitat. So basically, these guys really don't know what they're doing. They're just sort of floundering around. And when in doubt, you cut. When in doubt, you clear the, you manage. That's when in doubt. And so, for example, on Sparta Mountain in New Jersey, where they've been cutting and cutting and hacking for a number of years for golden winged warbler, guess what? There are no golden winged warblers. They, in fact, one of the sort of tongue in cheek things these guys say is, you know, the theory is basically if you cut it, they will come. Sort of like if you build it, they will come. And ho, 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 that's pretty funny. Yeah, well, except they don't come most of the time. Or if they do come, they're already in the area. And they, of course, early successional birds are very opportunistic. They'll, you know, blame them. They see some habitat, they zoom over there and take advantage. So this is one of the major poster children that they use, is the golden-winged warbler. While I'm on this, I should talk about another poster child, is the American woodcock. American woodcock, everything you see about young forests, they dredge up the woodcock because these, and I have nothing against woodcock. They're cute little birds. They have a huge, range, and they have gone down in numbers from what they were, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, just like all other early successional species, pretty much because the forests are growing back and they were artificially elevated because of all the clearing. But now their numbers are in the tens, you know, there are several million of them. I think it's they've gone down from, what was it, 5 million to 3 million or 6 million to 5 million. Anyway, it's millions. Every year, hunters kill a couple hundred thousand woodcock. Yet, supposedly, these woodcock are so endangered that we have to do large-scale clear cutting. In fact, there's a woodcock plan, a conservation plan that was put together by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and hunting groups and state hunting agencies, state wildlife agencies, and so forth. that calls for clear-cutting 11 million acres of forest in the eastern U.S. for habitat for woodcock. Now, that's the size of the state of Maryland. This is a kind of radical, extreme stuff. And there's no sign that the woodcock is the least bit endangered, but the numbers are going down. And, of course, hunters are used to seeing them all over the place. They could probably just pull up in a pickup truck and just blow several away. Now you can't. They're harder to find. So that's another one. And they've created this. And in fact, the woodcock hunting, interests are the ones who really have driven a larger campaign here. They decided that there's no way they could keep the numbers of woodcock elevated artificially, which is what they want, without a big program to, you know, there wasn't enough clear cutting going on in the East to keep the numbers up. So one of the things, so they hired a marketing firm to do public opinion research and find out what things people liked and didn't like. They found people hated clear cuts. So they hate early successional habitat. People didn't know what that was. So they said, oh, young forest. And then they said, oh, you should find other species because most people may not care about woodcock, so let's find other species that use young forests. And pretty soon they came up with the golden-winged warbler, and the northeast New England cottontail is another one that's a favorite of theirs. So they find these several, and of course there's no discussion in any of this of mycorrhizal fungi, about most insects or soil species that need intact soils, and of course old growth species. They basically pretend they don't exist, or they'll claim that actually they don't mind clear cuts at all and they do just fine. So really we don't need old growth forests at all. Actually, they don't say that because they know it sounds ridiculous, but that's basically sort of the way that they basically say, yeah, sure, we need a few little patches of old growth here or there, but overall they're done with old growth. So anyway.
So I want to go back to I was making a joke kind of about how did they survive before chainsaws, but
yes,
I want to before we go on about the insanity of turning older forests into younger forests, given everything that's happening around us. Before we do that, I want to talk for just a moment about, and just if you could make clear to people, how early successional forest dependent creatures, how they survived without management. Because, like, there is, I just love this story. There's in the West, there's a black-backed woodpecker. And the reason that these woodpeckers evolved black backs is because they love to go in after a fire, and then their back camouflages them against the burned bark. And so, like, or fireweed. I don't know if you have fireweed in the East, but fireweed is called fireweed for two reasons. One is, if you see a whole hillside of it, it looks like it's on fire because it's just beautiful red. But the other is, it's one of the first plants who comes in after a fire. And there are people, and I love this, there are people who talk about those sort of first succession plants as band-aids to cover a wound. You know, if there's a landslide, you have to have somebody come in as a first responder to fix things up.
Right.
So can you talk about the proper role? And don't worry, you know me well enough to know I'm not rationalizing cutting these forests. Talk about how in a healthy old growth forest, which would include a mosaic, which is going to be the key word, I believe, in a healthy old growth forest, in a healthy large scale functioning community, how would these early successional dependent birds, how would they live in a healthy functioning large-scale forest? That's the question.
Right. Well, there are two. One is to respond to what you just asked me, which I will, and the other part is how do the forest clearing people rationalize doing it nonetheless? And the first part is in the natural forest, most of the Northeast and the vast majority of the Northeast of New England and Northeast and most of the upper Midwest, and I'm talking about Northern Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota were covered with old growth forests with canopies and old trees. Not all the trees were old, but it was a very long-lived forest. And but these forests weren't like one big solid mat. They were, trees would blow down in storms. There were, in some parts of northern Minnesota, there were some natural wildfires, and also along the coast, the Atlantic coast in some places. There would be ice storms, beaver would flood areas, there were, you know, you'd have disease, insects, all those things would kill trees or make, you know, make openings. There'd be a hurricane once in a long while. And what would happen is trees would fall down, leave it, all of a sudden the sun could get to an area, there'd be a whole bunch of young forest. And there were other areas that were rocky or wetlands or whatever that it was very hard for trees to grow in. So those areas would stay open. And so there, it was, as you say, a mosaic. Even in old growth forests, the forestry people want you to sort of think of an old growth forest as this dark, dense, lifeless. It's just these big trees with these crowns and there's no sun and nothing grows underneath and whatever, which is totally bogus. It's just, you know, sure, there's some groves like that, mainly in the West, not in the East, but that's not the way they were. They were very diverse. And the important thing, and of course, so the species that evolved, when most of the landscape is that kind of a forest, most of the species are going to be adapted to that type of a habitat, not to open, sunny scrubland. So the species that needed that kind of habitat were not very common in the Northeast. Now, in the prairie in the Midwest, there were a lot of species that liked that kind of habitat, and they were very common, but not in the Northeast or the upper Great Lakes. So those species were never very common in the natural forest. The other important thing with that is, so when that forest was cut down, it turned most of the landscape into this early successional habitat, and those species just exploded in power. Well, the thing is, so what if you have large areas and you allow them to revert to the forest that was there before? And we know there are some areas where that has happened. A good example where there's actually been a study done is the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness and Voyageurs National Parks in northern Minnesota. And those are large areas of wilderness, and some of it is old growth forest that was never cut. Other areas have not been cut for a real long time, and so you've basically got, you've got an old growth forest covering hundreds of thousands of acres. And and there have been several studies. One of them that was really extensive looked at Boundary Waters Wilderness, which is about 1 million acres. And then it looked at the rest of Superior National Forest within which it lies, which is another 2 million acres or so. So 1 million acres is Boundary Waters Wilderness, not managed. And then 2 million acres are managed, i.e. logged like crazy. The Superior National Forest is one of the most heavily logged, hacked national forests. It's horrible. And so if there's any place where management ought to be a shining star of diversity, it should be Superior National Forest outside that dark, damp wilderness. Well, actually, the study found that the wilderness had more biodiversity than the managed areas, and it even had more diversity and larger numbers of early successional birds. They looked mainly at birds. And it's because there are natural openings in an old-growth forest. And the point is, gigantic clear cuts and denuded landscapes, after a point, they're actually not very good for anything to live in. And so so that's a real live example of a large wilderness area that's doing just fine in terms of the full range of habitats. Another, there have been a couple studies also of national parks in the East, including Great Smoky Mountains and Shenandoah and others, which found that in terms of trees, there's a greater diversity of tree species and more large trees and down trees and all the things of a healthy forest in these national parks than in the surrounding state or national parks than in the surrounding national forests, which are managed. So we know that if you leave a forest alone, even if it's been cut over, so most of the forests in the Northeast now are 100-ish years old or a little more maybe, because that's when the major clearing stopped and when all these cleared areas were abandoned to a great extent, and the forest has been growing back ever since. So you're talking about trees of, 75, 100, 120 maybe years old over large millions of acres in the Northeast. And the upper Midwest is a little younger, but it's getting there. So these areas are getting to the point of just on the verge of becoming second growth, old growth forests, the characteristics of an old growth forest. And these are the forests where now they're coming around and they're cutting them all down for various reasons. And the point is, and if you talk to these guys, what they'll tell you, you'll say, well, we know that if you leave a forest alone, if it's left alone, say, for example, there were hurricanes in the past. They could blow down thousands of acres of forest, basically blow down almost all the trees. Well, what happened? It didn't become a wasteland. It grew back. And so we know that forests grow back if you leave them alone. And after a while, they'll gain the diversity. They'll have openings and so forth. Well, if you talk to the real hardcore forest clearing guys, they'll say, well, I can't wait 100 years for that to develop openings. We need to do it now. What are you talking about? And when you drill down, it's because these guys grew up, most of these guys grew up or they studied with guys who grew up in the 1950s and 60s, when all these early successional species were everywhere. They were all over, and there were all these open, scrubby areas. That's their favorite landscape. They're used to that. They went out with their dads and went hunting. They're all hunters, pretty much. And so they're basically trying to replicate their favorite landscape from when they were youngsters. And it really is it's a cultural thing. That's why, as I say, none of these species, or none of them that we could see, need this artificial large-scale clearing of forests to survive or thrive. So why are they doing it? It's because they want to see these species. These are their favorite. They like these species. They like these species. You don't see them pining for wolves and for mountain lions and for old-growth lycans and mycorrhizal fungi. You never hear them saying, my God, we don't have enough of them. What are we going to do? We need habitat for them. They never talk about that. They never talk about wilderness. They never talk about large old growth areas. They talk about their favorite early successional species. So, that's their right to like those species, but don't pretend that this is science, really. It's not science. It's cultural behavior. But they dress it up as science, and most people believe that, this is really all scientific, and gee, how can we oppose this? Even though we hate these ugly giant clear cuts, how can we say no when they're saving all these birds?
So I don't know about in the East, but in the West, among a lot of normal people, some normal people, timber companies have lost. I mean, timber company says something, and a lot of people are cynical enough to know, yeah, they're lying so they can cut.
Right.
But my understanding is that what you're dealing with in the East there is not simply timber companies, but also a fair number of especially large-scale environmental organizations. Is that accurate?
Yes. And the timber, that's why I say it's an alliance of convenience. So timber companies are happy to use this cover to say, oh, yes, we're doing, they have what they call foresters for the birds. Have you ever heard of that? This is sponsored by Audubon. What it is they say, oh, we're going to train foresters to do bird-friendly forestry. And they're not only going to produce needed wood products, but they're going to help golden wing warblers and other species. And so they, you know, this is all, and of course the timber industry has jumped onto this. And so, and the same with forestry agencies, state forestry agencies and the U.S. Forest Service now, is using this excuse big time. So, it's the same as fire in the West is the same thing. It's the same basic thing. As you know, there are things you can do to reduce your house's burnability and so forth, but most of the stuff they're doing is really just fake. We're going to thin for fuel reduction, whatever. And again, the timber industry loves it. They're happy to go right along. So it's basically analogous to fire in the West. It's a joke to say the fire is a big threat in the East. So they pretty much have given up on that. Although they still use that, easily debunked.
So you said something in the middle there that mm-hmm. made me really happy. And that is that there are a lot of forests that are, I don't know, 120 years old that mm-hmm. were previously cut, but are now yep. starting to get some, let's sort of call them sort of younger old growth characteristics, are mm-hmm. starting to develop some old yep. growth characteristics. And right. that, it's not an exaggeration to say that there is little in the world that makes me happier than to hear that a place that was at one point trashed beginning to take on healthy characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I just wanted to say that explicitly in the midst of this conversation right. about them destroying those places again.
Yes, exactly.
And this is like an honest to goodness. I mean, in a world of, one of the ways I used to start my talks about environmental stuff is the quote I used to use, it was a quote from me. The line I used to use was, as a longtime grassroots environmental activist and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss. Oh, I carry the daily weight of despair and I'm intimately mm-hmm. acquainted with the landscape of loss. So mm-hmm. when I hear a story like there are thousands or millions of acres that are recovering, that makes me ecstatic.
Yep. Well, and it's because despite ourselves, the ecosystems in the, and again, in the region we're talking about, the Northeast, which is the, up north, northern Atlantic coast in New England and the upper Great Lakes, these are extremely resilient ecosystems. Despite ourselves, all the stuff we've done, they just insist on coming back. And they're not exactly the same, of course, that they were in 1600. But unlike parts of the West, where if you clear cut some area, it turns into, you know, it's a mudslide and it just really devastates the ecosystem. And you're lucky if native species are able to recover. They just hack the forest away. And the same native species come on back. And now they start with the early successional species, but then it progresses. Those species get shaded out by the trees when the trees get bigger and they recede and then the trees take over and then some of the longer lived trees take over from there. And then there's a big storm or whatever and it opens it up and then it starts over again. So yes, if we just leave alone, there are huge areas in the Northeast. Well, I mean, the national forests and state lands, and there are large timberlands in northern Maine, of course, that we proposed as a national park. These are all recovering natural forests. These are not big plantations of monoculture or whatever. They're the same native species, basically, that were there hundreds of years ago. They're just in a different stage of succession. And what the problem is, these guys are going around and they're clear cutting everywhere they can, creating this patchwork, which is the opposite of what you want with a, you know, this is not a natural patchwork. These are, you know, clear cuts and roads and they're bringing in exotic species on the treads of their trucks and feller bunchers. And what we need right now is large patches of forest that we leave alone, so you reinstate these natural disturbance regimes, and that allows species to recover. And we still are missing wolves and mountain lions and a few other things, but overall, most of the native major species are somewhere in the region. So the missing piece, though, is that this young forest stuff is an excuse to not do any permanent protection of any large areas. And for example, the Green Mountain National Forest is doing what is just hacking the forest right now. It's unbelievable. And it's mainly with this excuse of early successional habitat. There's not one species they have identified that needs this to survive or thrive. It's totally bogus. And also, they're doing this cutting in roadless areas, in inventory roadless areas because of a loophole. So actually, in the White Mountain National Forest has systematically, in New Hampshire and in Maine, has systematically driven roads and logging into roadless areas that had grown back and were not old growth, but were getting to the point of, you know, approaching old growth. And they deliberately go into these areas to disqualify them from being wilderness. So they hack away at the edges of all these pieces. The reality is, this is a 5-alarm fire, and we cannot allow these guys whose brains they fell asleep in the 1950s and they don't get it. These are the guys who are running the show right now, and we cannot allow these industrial management guys to control the fate of these forests. Once they clear cut these areas, it's going to take 100 years just to get them back to the way they are now. And, on the other hand, if we leave them alone, they're going to be a huge part of the solution to climate change, biodiversity loss. And also, as you know, there's more and more scientific solid evidence that humans need green natural areas for their health and well-being. So even if we only care about people, we're doing the wrong thing. So and their reasoning is so lame, and it's based in such thin. That's what's shocking, is they really have very little to support all of this stuff. It's really just sort of folklore, kind of forest management folklore. Well, I go out there in the forest. I've been going on in the forest for decades. Let me tell you, I can tell you, when I see the trees, they're too close together. And, I don't see enough open area, and there's not enough regeneration. So, don't tell me about, blah, blah, blah. That's basically the level of science that really is driving this. I'm sorry. Over time, I've lost. There are really very few of these guys who I think actually know what they're doing. They're good at, scientific theory, and they do these little mini research projects or whatever, but there's no, for example, there's no large landscape where they have said, okay, let's look at a big wilderness area and then we'll leave that alone. And then for 100 years, we're going to manage another area for 100 years, and then we're going to see how it comes out and see if which one looks better. Nobody's ever done that. They've never done that. And in fact, that, as I said, that study of Boundary Waters canoe area wildernesses, that's the kind of thing that actually shows that they're totally wrong. But they don't do that kind of study. There's no large scale ecosystem wide stuff. It's all these little narrow, small, aimed at just their favorite species. It's like a couple dozen birds always, their favorite birds, and, New England cottontail, the rabbit. And there's lots of doubt now that that species needs any management to do well. So it's just a house of cards, I think, that needs to be exposed.
So we have like 5 or 10 minutes left, and a couple of things. One of them is, you mentioned, blowdowns of huge, yep, of very large areas.
Yeah.
And one thing you didn't mention there is a difference between a huge blowdown and a clear cut. Is that the blowdown, the wood remains. And so can you talk for a moment about the importance of dead trees for fireflies, salamanders, anybody, and future trees.
Well, I mean, this is one of the myths, forestry myths, is that clear cutting mimics disturbances, fire, blowdowns, or whatever, which is totally bogus. It's totally not true. I mean, this is the way foresters think, that to them, that looks like the same thing. But as you say, and there's been analysis looking at areas that were hurt, you know, where hurricane blew things down. And yes, of course, all the trees there, number one. Number two, a lot of this stuff doesn't get, even in the biggest storms, they're still standing. A few trees are living. There are a lot of standing trees that are dead. Those are all habitats, future habitats for a lot of species. And then, of course, the trees that are blown down are habitat for, as you say, salamanders, fungi, insects. A lot of birds, you know, thrive on the insects that are going to go and eat eat that wood and eat the blown down leaves and so forth. So it's totally still an ecosystem. The forest starts to regenerate and come back very quickly. And it's the same. It's a native. They're native species that come back, and this is the way it's evolved. Whereas you clear cut it, you're removing everything. Most of that carbon from that forest is going to end up in the atmosphere very quickly. It's going to stay in the atmosphere for 1,000 years. As opposed to with a hurricane, the blowdown wood, big trees, it can take 100 years for those trees to rot away. And when they do, a lot of that ends up in the soil, not in the air, a lot of the carbon. So it's a completely different thing. It shows how shallow the sensibilities are of the forest management people, that they see any similarity between a natural catastrophic, quote unquote, event and clear cutting or any kind of management stuff. And I should say the only solution, we end up our paper with a solution, because there's so many things that people hear that are so disturbing and depressing. It sounds like everything's going to hell in a handbasket, but that the solution is we need to get these guys out of lands. We need public lands. We need to protect our public lands. We need more national parks. We need more wilderness areas. We need to get rid of logging for early successional wildlife, period. It makes no sense. You know, if there are natural open meadows or whatever, maybe it makes sense to, if there's something preventing them from being protected, maybe that makes sense. But we need permanent and of large expanses. Here we're talking about saving 30% of the planet, at least, for biodiversity and carbon and whatever. What are we doing to get there? In fact, this early successional logging is the opposite of that. It's the complete opposite. Here we are. Our public lands are being hacked by these guys for no good reason. It's not even, I mean, if it really were doing a lot of good, you'd say, well, gee, it's a trade-off. What are you going to do? It's not. It's useless. It's just doing a bunch of damage for a few favorite birds of a few people. And most people have no idea this is going on. That's the other thing, of course, that nobody knows about this whole campaign. It's almost invisible to most people. They go, why are they cutting down that wildlife management area? Why are they clear cutting there? And they go, oh, well, it's for birds and bunnies, and trust us, it'll all turn out well.
I think I have I think I have a solution to all of this that would make everybody but the managers happy, including the golden wing warblers, which is if you want some more early successional forest, what you do is you take a parking lot and you rip up the asphalt and you allow the forest that is there underneath the parking lot to become an early successional forest.
Well, actually, that is not completely crazy. In our paper, we talk about the fact, for example, golf courses.
Yeah, exactly.
There are a lot of golf courses that are gone, you know, go out of business or whatever. And those can be, you know, they have a lot of artificial turf or whatever, but they could be nurtured back into early successional habitats. That might be a good thing. Who knows? It'd be better than a golf course. That's totally right. And the other part of this, which I didn't mention, is they claim that there's this big, there's a real shortage of the early successional habitat. Well, from everything we've seen, and we documented in our paper, actually there's more early successional habitat now than there was in 1600. There's more. There's no shortage. There's plenty of it. I mean, anybody who drives around in the Northeast, as you say, you got golf courses, you got power line rights away, you got highway rights away, you got people's backyards, you got, you know, parks with open areas, you got there's habitat all over. The reason these species are declining is because they were grossly, their numbers were artificially elevated way beyond what they normally would be, and now they're just moving back to being more of their normal numbers. So we're not against early, you know, I don't hate these early successional wildlife. I want them to have a home, but I think there's plenty of place for them without this artificial management.
So here's two final things, three final things. One is, can you tell people how they can read this particular article? Because I thought the article itself was so well put.
Oh, good. Well, we tried to make it readable by normal people because a lot of these things are not. So glad to hear that.
So how do people actually read, you know, say, do you want me to say the title? I'll say the title again, and then you can say whatever else you want about it.
Okay.
Forest clearing to create early successional habitats, questionable benefits, significant costs. So should people just look it up online, or you got a better idea?
They could do that. They can, and it's Kellett et al. 2023, if you put Kellett, I'm the first listed author, so if you put that with Kellett, it probably will pop up. Also, our website, the Restore website, I believe now we have posted a link with a short summary. Maybe it's got the abstract. And the Restore website is restore.org. So if you go there, and I think under the forests link, or menu item, you'll find it there too.
So
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say that either one of those, you should find it, because it's really, this, as far as I know, this is the first paper that anybody has actually put this all together in one place. It's shocking, but this is one of the reasons we did it, is we thought somebody's got to do this. Somebody's got to put all these pieces together and in a coherent narrative. So
the last thing for today, a place, one of the reasons that I love interviewing you, and I've interviewed you so many times, is because of your important, the notion that we don't need to manage and that forests can take care of themselves. And I'm going to say one thing from what you said, and then I want you to just give a final speech on non-management of forests or grasslands or anything else. Mm-hmm. And the thing you said was, you said, you know, you took on the voice of one of these managers and said, oh, the trees are too close together. Well, when I moved here to the land where I live, the land is now, the trees are probably now about 50 years old. They were 25 years old when I moved in, and a lot of them were too close together. And A, you know what I did, which is nothing. B, you know what the trees did? They thin themselves out.
Right, exactly.
And so if the trees are too close together, let them deal with it. And so, so can you give us one, I think the most important thing anybody can talk about, and one of the most important things that I think you talk about, is the unnecessity of management. So can you give us like a 3-minute, just give us your 3-minute best shot on the importance of non-management.
Yeah. Well, the whole concept of the need for management is just a human. It's the way, you know, I think it's ingrained in humans. It's like with rivers and dams. If people see a river, free flowing river, and what are they, you know, you got somebody who's going to say, oh my God, that water's all going to waste and it's flowing to the ocean. Let's put a dam there and we'll manage it. And it's just, it's like, I think it's humans, and it probably was a good thing millions of years, a couple million years ago, for people to, you know, they had to live in the environment around them, and they had to adjust it to fit so they could survive. And today, of course, with our numbers and our technology, we overwhelm the natural systems with this, with our clunky attempts at management. And but the reality is, if you look at just look at the reality on the ground of areas that have recovered in the Northeast, Baxter State Park in Maine, the whole area was cut over, and Percival Baxter bought these lands from timber companies and just left them alone, literally just left it alone. Today, people go out there, they think that it's never been cut. And this is, you know, the last piece he bought was like in the 1960s. So it's not even that old. So the reality is, now, if you're talking about, you know, Tallgrass Prairie, where it was turned into cornfields, there may be some need for restoration management to reseed or whatever. That, you know, if the ecosystem has really been destroyed. But that's not what we're talking about with forests, especially in the East. It's because this is a human conceit that we can and should be managing things. There's no proof that it's necessary. There's really no proof that, because think about it, that these forests have only been, we've only been, quote, managing forests for about 100 years. Where's the proof that any of this has been necessary or beneficial in the larger sense? There is none. This is a scientific experiment with no control across the landscape. I mean, imagine clearing an entire landscape and then having it grow back and then hacking away at it again with no control. No control whatsoever. Talk about science. It's totally not science. So if you have human goals, if you have land that you're going to grow trees for timber to produce logs for furniture or something, sure. You're going to have to manage just like a cornfield. But to pretend that you need to manage as a natural ecosystem for its own good. I mean, they basically claim, oh, the forest needs us for health and diversity and blah, blah, blah. And there's no evidence that they'll claim, oh, we need it for resilience or climate change, because these are all aged forests. They all are growing up at the same time, and they're all going to fall over at the same time, which is totally not true. So there's just no evidence that it's true that we need to manage forests for their own good. And so don't pretend that it's being done for the good of the forest. It's being done for human purposes. And if, you know, in some cases, maybe that's valid, but don't tell us that it's for the good of the forest. There's no evidence that's true, or wildlife or biodiversity. It's just totally not true. And there's plenty of evidence that of that fact. We just visited Great Smoky Mountain National Park a year or two ago. And, you know, for the average person, they probably think that forest has never been cut. Yet most of it was farmland 100 years ago or more recently. Yet the nature is recovering. It's incredibly biodiverse. And as I say, there have been studies that have shown that it's more biodiverse than the managed areas around it. So anyway, the people who tell you we need to manage, let's see the evidence. Let's see their evidence versus looking at natural areas that have been left alone. I think anybody would say those areas look pretty good without management.
Well, thank you. Thank you for all of that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Michael Kellett. This is Derek Gentleman for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.